From Princeton University's Blue Lab, this is Carried by Water. I'm Mario Soriano. As images of Haiyan's destruction flooded the media, an outpouring of humanitarian aid and volunteer responders from around the world descended into the affected regions to help. Many of them came as part of local and international organizations. They launched different projects, including providing emergency medical care, distributing relief goods and shelter kits, and even helping with long-term reconstruction. In our previous episode, we heard views on the relative success of resettlement projects led by non-government organizations compared to housing projects from the government. We also learned about some present-day struggles of Haiyan survivors in these newly formed communities. This episode, we'll hear more about the legacies of the monumental humanitarian effort that mobilized in the wake of Haiyan's devastation. We'll learn about NGO contributions to providing relief in the immediate aftermath of the typhoon, as well as their sustained efforts toward permanent housing and local capacity building. We'll also hear about challenges in coordinating the massive international response, resulting in perceptions of inequity during the aid distribution process. Finally, we'll hear about the creation of new shared spaces between locals and foreign volunteers that enable genuine connections beyond a benefactor-beneficiary dynamic. Episode 5, An Organized Chaos. Part 1, Compassionate Relief and Rebuilding. When it comes to NGOs that helped Tacloban's recover, one name kept coming up during our interviews.
Chuchi.
Chuchi Foundation.
Tulong na galing sa Chuchi Foundation.
The Buddhist Chuchi Charity Foundation.
It's actually Chuchi, but sometimes when we say Chuchi, if you read the letters, you cannot connect Chuchi with the letters that you see. So Chuchi, Chu is compassion, Chi is relief. So with compassion, we try to relieve the sufferings of beings in this world.
That's Peggy C. Jiang. She's a volunteer who works within the office of the CEO of Chuchi Philippines. We spoke with her and other volunteers at their office grounds in a former school campus near the Pasig River in Manila. Chuchi was founded in Taiwan in 1966 and has established a global presence, having provided relief aid to at least 120 countries. Its founder is a Buddhist nun who the volunteers refer to as Dharma Master Cheng Yan. Profiles of Cheng Yan in Time magazine and Forbes have compared her to Mother Teresa for her humanitarian work. According to one volunteer who requested anonymity, the Chuchi Philippines volunteers were in Taiwan when Yolanda struck, and it was Cheng Yan herself who told them that something had happened and they had to mobilize immediately. A press release mentions that Chuchi volunteers arrived in Ormoc, Leyte on November 13, 2013 and reached Tacloban 2 days later.
Chuchi Foundation was one of those NGOs who were the first to go in the area. And we can say we're the last to leave because up until now, we're still there.
Peggy herself arrived in Tacloban 1 month after Haiyan, when the entire focus was still on providing immediate relief to the survivors.
I came in around December. So that's already like a month after. When I entered the city, there was still no electricity and no water. So we had to bring in our generator set from Manila and Cebu to bring in to Tacloban so we can run our operations. So the whole Go Hotel in Tacloban, we already got the whole building. And we said we need this for our own operations because every day we had to cook like 10,000 meals. And it's because of the wisdom of our master. Our Taiwan office, they have this instant rice. You can just submerge the instant rice with water and in 50 minutes, it will become rice. And it has also flavoring, like instant noodles. It has flavoring and dehydrated vegetables. So we use those instant rice to be able to cook for 10,000 people on a daily basis.
These days, Tu Chi is focusing its efforts on permanent housing. In February 2023, the foundation broke ground and started construction of its first permanent housing project, the so-called Great Love Village in Palo, Leyte, just south of Tacloban. The volunteer in charge of this endeavor is architect Jem Mariel Lim.
27 years of Tu Chi's existence here with the Filipino people, this is the first permanent housing that they will be doing. Our design ethos, we wanted to create a historical, inclusive, livable, disaster-prepared, sustainable master plan community for all.
Jem told us that she and her team made 27 concept revisions over 5 years of planning, based on direct feedback from the Dharma Master.
There is a law in the Philippines for economic and socialized housing. The minimum is 18 square meters. So for the government, we do 18 square meters for socialized housing. One question that the master asked us before that I think I won't forget, when we were designing the 18 square meter, because we presented the 18 square meter to the master, the Dharma master. And then she asked us, would you put your family there? And we were put aback kasi, syempre, we don't want to put our family there. So then why would you design something like that? So we were really forced to think and be sensitive to the people that we were giving. No, that's how we change or we envision the socialized housing in the Philippines. So this is averagely 50 square meters each for each family.
The Great Love Village is being built next to where Tu Chi originally housed its beneficiaries in prefabricated transitional shelters. There were originally 250 families in these transitional shelters, and Tu Chi's initial plan was to include all of them in its permanent housing project. In the intervening years, a number of families have agreed to move to government-sponsored units from the National Housing Authority. And this also influenced the planning and redesign of Great Love Village. 60 families remain for Tu Chi's Great Love Village in Palo.
So the total lot area for this is 14,428 square meters or roughly around 3.5 acres of land. No. We have 17 residential buildings that cater 60 families. We have 4 training center, a daycare, multipurpose hall, and a central kitchen.
Peggy and Jem were kind enough to fly to Leyte and meet our team on site in Palo to give us a tour of the then nascent Great Love Village. We stop near a worker welding roof trusses in the midst of a bustling construction site. Similar to the situation in the sweat equity program implemented by other NGOs, many of the construction workers working at the site are also the future homeowners. It was a damp day when drizzles would come on and off. The light rain and muddy ground did not seem to bother the workers laying the foundations, columns, and frames of what would become their new homes.
So, this is the... Now your turn.
Wait, I wasn't ready for that.
All columns and posts.
So this is the Tsuchi Great La Village permanent housing. We have three models. As you can see with the roof trusses, we have Model A, Model B, and Model C. So we have each unit has four families living in it. So you can see the mock-up. That's one. You see the living, we have kitchen, bedroom, dining, and all. So, yeah. We have 60 units, or for 60 families here now. So, yeah, the too old tree is this tree. The one that didn't collapse.
Philippine rosewood.
Oh, yeah. It's Philippine
the
rosewood.
All this tree.
So, we made it a symbol of this. Community, the one that didn't fall during Yolanda.
In the middle of the village is a giant tree that is believed to be 100 years old and survived Typhoon Yolanda. It is a Philippine rosewood, which the locals call Toog. One of us misheard this and thought they were saying that the tree was too old. And from that point forward, everyone on the tour called the Toog tree the too old tree for us. Jem's team decided to keep this tree as a visual reminder of the resilience of the Yolanda survivors. The Toog is a very tall tree, with the species typically reaching 40 to 60 meters in height. Two large tanks at the base of the tree caught my eye. I asked Jem what they're for.
Oh, the problem here is that we don't have a tap. I mean, we don't have a proper water line. So our short-term solution is that we will be doing a deep well. Oh, and then we'll be raising this to sustain the water.
So that everyone can have
water.
We the also water source would have to be done by the local government.
Mm-hmm. Or
that one has to come from there.
And then we have...
So, the Great Love Village will be relying on an aquifer for its water supply while waiting for the municipal government to provide a connection to the local water utility. Interesting stuff for a groundwater hydrologist. You can listen back to episode 3 for a case study on how soil dependence on coastal aquifers might prove to be a vulnerability during a storm surge disaster. Anyway, we met Edgar, one of the construction workers on site and a future permanent homeowner. He said he was born in neighboring Samar Island but was living with his wife and children in Barangay Salvacion here in Palo when Yolanda struck.
Kaya doon ako na Yolanda.
That's where Yolanda got me. After the storm, we were not allowed to return to where we were living because it was so close to the sea. I think it's just from here up to that wall over there. We were not allowed to live there anymore. That's why we agreed to be relocated here by Tsuchi. I'm really willing to be here. If I didn't have many people depending on me, I'd be okay with working here without getting paid. Because I'm really willing to get a house. I won't leave this job until it's finished.
Edgar says he never lost hope that he would eventually get a house in this ideal location.
It's such a wonderful feeling. We've been waiting for this for a long time. Others have told me that I'm waiting for nothing, but I said no, we'll get it someday. What I want is to be here. It's close to the market, it's close to a school. That's why I really wanted to be here.
Another future homeowner we met was Teacher Genevieve, the preschool teacher in the village. Her class will also be transitioning from the prefabricated classroom they used for 8 years to a new permanent building.
I'm pre-key teacher po. I handle 3 to 5 years old children. I'm very proud to have my new building. Unlike the other one, but it's okay. For past 8 years, that room I love very much. Yeah, but I know I have a 5-star when I got it. I hope that all children in the village go to a good school so that their future will be good.
Teacher Genevieve says she feels blessed to be in the Great Love Village.
I was so very thankful to God and Master Qingyan for giving us a permanent house. I was so touched because when Yolanda came, I'm totally nothing. I don't have a house. I don't have a job. I don't have everything. We're walking anywhere in the street. We don't know how we're going to sleep. So it's very hard for us. That's why I'm very thankful to Tzu Chi Foundation for giving us a permanent shelter.
Tzu Chi's on-site livelihood programs include sewing, a mushroom farm, gardening, baking, and vegetarian catering. As a Buddhist organization, the foundation promotes a plant-based diet. Residents of the village are encouraged to abide by the foundation's values, and activities such as drinking liquor and gambling are prohibited. The Great Love Village will have a central kitchen for the catering business, training halls, and a multi-purpose hall that can also function as an evacuation center.
So learning from the past, we now have this area where they can evacuate in case of emergency. So we have the multi-purpose area that is equipped with toilets, showers. We have the central kitchen that is located within that zone. In case of emergency, we have food, we have shelter, we have hygiene and all.
Construction at the Great Love Village in Palo is expected to be complete by the first half of this year. So the people in the transitional shelters, like Edgar and Teacher Genevieve, will finally be able to move to their new homes soon. Now let's go back to Tacloban and rewind to the days immediately after Yolanda. One big reason Tzu Chi gained such prominence in Tacloban is because of their cash for work and cash assistance programs. The cash for work program paid people 500 pesos per day for cleaning up the debris from Haiyan, twice the daily wage back in 2013. Later, after consulting with their Dharma master, the foundation also implemented what it called cash for relief. This cash assistance was based on family size. Families with one or two members would get 8,000 pesos. Those with three or four would get 12,000. And those with five or more would receive 15,000 pesos. Here's Peggy again.
I remember also when we were doing the cash assistance, we had to check on the number of family members, because 1 to 2 would be 8,000, 3 to 4, 12,000, and 15,000. So I was asking one by one just to make sure that the list that we have is correct. I was asking this big burly guy, but his eyes were all red. And I was asking him, so how many members do you have? Because on my list, I see 7. And then he said, we were 7 before, but now we're just 2. So I also have had to control my emotions, but I had to correct the name list and correct it with just two. So he lost 5 of his family members during the typhoon.
Our interviewees fondly remember Tsuchi for not discriminating who to give assistance to. The foundation's generosity was much appreciated by the typhoon survivors, but it proved to be a bane for other NGOs working in the area, as Tsuchi's higher rates attracted more workers to its own programs and left other programs scrambling. Thin Le Win of Thomson Reuters reported in February 2014, quote, "Cash Flux Buddhist Org comes to rescue in storm-hit Philippines but breaks NGO rules," end quote.
When we started giving 500 pesos for the cash for cleanup, a lot of the other NGOs were questioning, because at that time, the minimum wage was 250 pesos in Tacloban, but we were giving double the amount. And because we had huddles every day in the United Nations makeshift office, so we have to send one representative to go to the UN office and then talk about what each NGO was doing. The UN representatives and other NGOs were questioning, why are you giving 500 pesos? They said, our workers are going for your cash for work because you're offering double.
Peggy said it also took her some time to understand the reasoning behind the large cash assistance.
So at the start, we also did not understand what Master Cheng Yen's goal was for giving 500 pesos. But after 19 days of cash for cleanup, then we saw that because they had 500 pesos, people started having the money and the capacity to start to buy. They are able to buy the eggs, then they're able to buy water and the rice. And then the cash assistance also became the seed money for them to start their own small businesses. People started selling in the wet market. And then we started seeing small kiosks, you know, people who laid down their wares and started selling. And then I think then that's when we actually also understood what Master Cheng Yen was aiming for. She wanted to kickstart the economy.
It's unclear if there were any penalties for breaking agreed-upon rates for cash for work, or whether there was even anyone who could impose such rules strictly in the chaotic post-Yolanda landscape. Overall, Tsuchi has spent about 3.2 billion pesos, or around $57 million, in its Yolanda recovery activities to date. The foundation has received recognition from the Philippine government for this work. Part 2: A City of Boat Landings. One of the volunteers in Tsuchi's very first delegation to Tacloban was Doc Anton Lim.
I've been a first responder to a lot of calamity, and this was not my first time, but the degree of destruction, like as far as your eyes can see, there was just massive destruction. And you see a lot of people walking around aimlessly. I think they were in shock because they were just walking. You can see them walking back and forth, just looking around, looking for dead bodies. You see wailing here. You see suddenly somebody will be crying, shouting somewhere when they locate a corpse on nearby. What I cannot forget is the stench. Yeah, until now, the smell is really, it's what bothers you. There were, you know, smell of rotten corpse, and you can see them with pot-bellied, and you see kids, you see babies there lying around. And it's easy to fault government, but the degree of destruction was just everywhere.
Doc Anton is the co-founder of another NGO.
I'm Dr. Anton Marie H. Lim. I'm the co-founder, president, and CEO of Yellow Boat of Hope Foundation. Yellow Boat of Hope started when a friend of ours relayed the story to my co-founder, Jay Jaboneta, about seeing kids having to swim daily to go to school. So he was on his way to visit some relatives in some coastal community. Actually, it's in a mangrove community. When the boat was approaching the shore, he saw several sort of like trash floating. But when the boat got near the shore, he realized that they were not trash, but actually kids holding, one hand holding to their a plastic bag containing their uniform and their school supplies, while the other hand was swimming to go to their school. At that time, he said he didn't know if he was going to laugh or he was going to cry. So the first opportunity he had to talk to us, he relayed to us the story. So the first time we heard about it, I was sort of guarded in my opinion. But after a while, we found the community. And as I was nearing the shore, I saw for myself kids doing that. That was the story. That just goes to show how one story can create impact.
Yellow Boat started in 2010 to provide boats needed by these children to go to their schools. The boats were painted yellow to mirror school buses. The NGO was well positioned to help fishermen whose boats were destroyed by Yolanda.
When we went there, we saw the fishermen, a lot of them, were falling in line, waiting for relief goods from government. So a relief goods normally would be like a pack with 5 kilos of rice, a can of sardines, and several instant noodles. So that was the standard. And I remember talking to one of the fishermen there, and he said, you know, we're fishermen. We're not beggars. And I don't know why we have to wait in line several hours just to get a can of sardines when we can harvest fresh fishes in the ocean. So he said, just give us a boat and government can focus on some other people.
Doc Anton told us that Yellow Boat recognized the livelihood benefits that providing boats could generate, and they quickly mobilized across multiple Hiam affected regions.
We started looking for local boat makers because we realized it's very important not just to give them boats, but actually inject money into the local economy so that they can stand on their own. By the time we closed the project in Yolanda area, we have built over 1,000 boats already. And that's across not just in Tacloban, but in northern Cebu, all the way to Palawan. These areas in northern Cebu and even in Palawan, they were not a focus of the media, but they were victims as well.
Yellow Boat calls its program implementers Hope Paddlers. In Tacloban and surrounding areas in Leyte and Samar, the organization's main hope paddler was Kokoy Torrevillas. We spoke to Kokoy in the town of Marabut in Samar Island. Kokoy told us that after Doc Anton recruited him to Yellow Boat, he started looking for places that were being left out of material aid from other humanitarian organizations.
I'm just roaming around looking for people in needs, like Edie. That time they didn't have livelihood, then no other NGO been here that time. So we are the one, we are the first here in this barangay. We help them. So we are the first. Other places, there are plenty of NGO already. So I look around, that those who are being ignored or forgotten barangays or people. That was 2014, February 2014.
That Eddie that he mentioned is Eddie Pica, a boatmaker in Barangay Kaluwayan here in Marabut. According to Kokoy, disaster relief had yet to arrive in this village, which is about an hour drive east of Tacloban, 3 months after the typhoon. Eddie, the boatmaker, said Kokoy found him by the roadside, sitting on the remnants of his boat.
Pag umaga, Wala na yung mga bahay namin.
After the typhoon, all our houses were gone. We just slept on tents we put up beside the road. One day, Sir Kokoy passed by. He saw me and my boat, with just half of it left. He said, "Oh, you have a boat." I said, "Yes, but Yolanda cut it in half." We spoke some more and he offered me the opportunity to make boats for their foundation.
Eddie told us he also mobilized some of his neighbors to help in the boat-making endeavor and provide livelihood for them as well. Kokoy told us they ended up distributing 36 mechanized boats in Barangay Kaluwayan alone and around 200 in the Leyte and Samar area. Eddie told us he lost 8 family members to Yolanda. He was expressing his gratitude to Kokoy for helping him get a new start when memories of his hardships overcame him with emotion.
I'm very thankful for Sir Kokoy passing by that day. He trusted me and gave me an opportunity. Until now, he trusts me.
Naiyak lang ako sa pinagdaanan ko noon.
Remembering the hardships I went through just makes me cry. I'm sorry. Sometimes, I just can't help but cry. It was so difficult for us, me and my family. That's why I'm so thankful to Kokoy for entrusting me with that opportunity. Thank you.
A recurring sentiment we encountered in our research was that, with all the attention and material aid pouring only into Tacloban, many places felt they had been forgotten. This is partly due to the difficulty in coordinating the efforts of the tons of humanitarian agencies that descended into the region. I asked Doc Anton to summarize what he saw in the relief operations.
How would you assess the overall response to Yolanda?
It was... Well, when I'm asked that question, I always tell them it was an organized chaos. No one is to blame because of the magnitude of the problem, but I saw government doing their best. Honestly, when I saw them, I can see the Secretary of Department of Social Welfare and Development waking up 3 in the morning, working all the way till like 2 in the morning. Because we were part of that too. We were trying to coordinate and see how we can fit in and how we can share resources. Like, it was very hard to bring in even 100 sack of rice because the only connection was using the naval ship. So we have to do a lot of coordination. And as days progress, government was able to streamline a lot of things. But then again, it was really challenging. No one was prepared for it. Even the U.S. Army, they set up a command station to help the Philippines. They could only do so much because the devastation was so widespread. So everybody pitched in.
In Tacloban, so many agencies were distributing boats that the city soon became known as the City of Boat Landings. Brando Bernadas from the City Disaster Risk Office.
One thing bad about presence of different international humanitarian response group, they could hardly even coordinate with each other. As if they are competing among themselves, which is not a good sign. You could just imagine one humanitarian help, another humanitarian help with the same impact. We were even criticized as a city of boat landings. Many assistance on fish fox. Many assistance on mechanized bankas. But they were never used at all because they were not fishermen who were able to receive this assistance. So it's difficult. But we cannot stop them because that is their program design.
Part 3. long-term impacts of short-term presence. It's hard to overstate the outpouring of international attention that Tacloban received in the aftermath of the super typhoon. But as our previous stories illustrate, equitable distribution of aid was a difficult task. Ella Atienza, political scientist from UP Diliman.
The overall response was actually overwhelming. There were so many people who responded. But at the same time also, there was no system to coordinate all this assistance, because there was no well-coordinated system in place. It was difficult. There were so many organizations coming in and they don't know which place to go to. So it was very confusing. Some NGOs that we talked with said that because there was no plan, no regional DRRM plan, it was difficult to prioritize which areas need more help and what are the needs per area. So there was a tendency for some areas to receive more assistance, some areas receive less, some areas receive none.
Apart from some places feeling forgotten, some sectors also felt neglected in the response.
One of the usual complaints was there were too many boats distributed to many of these areas, because the assumption was they live near the sea, so people were fisher folks. But not everyone were relying on fishing for livelihood. Some, of course, work in factories, some work as jeepney or tricycle drivers. Some people admitted, oh, we received 2 or 3 boats, but we cannot sell them. So they were just left there, decaying. Whereas in some areas, genuine fisher folks did not receive any assistance. So you have these types of duplication of assistance, wastage of assistance, and in some cases, not well thought of interventions.
These realities created social tensions and reinforced pre-existing power dynamics and aid dependence in some cases. In particular, because of their dole-outs of cash assistance and relief goods, some NGOs unintentionally replicated patron-client relations and perceptions of global North dominance.
Some of the aid agencies and the NGOs that we interviewed, some of their representatives have admitted and pointed out their own contributions to the perpetuation of the patron-clientelistic relationship, as well as, of course, many of them have started becoming self-aware in the sense that when you have too many foreigners, particularly white people in certain areas, you also create the idea of the global North as being the dominant one. So you replicate the power relationship.
Atienza's comment about NGOs realizing the pitfalls of having too many foreign volunteers is twofold. The first component is logistical. Many of the international aid workers did not have time to familiarize themselves with the local emergency response protocols, aggravating the difficulties of coordination in the post-disaster landscape. Local NGOs we spoke to also pointed out that the international agencies likely influenced price increases of relief goods, construction materials, and even land for purchase for resettlement projects. International agencies also took over most of the hotels, making it difficult for local volunteers to find decent accommodations. Local NGOs we spoke to told us they had to sleep in churches or convents. The second component is cultural and more nuanced. A legacy of the country's colonial past is what historian Vicente Rafael refers to as white love. That is, desire and deference towards light-skinned people. The sudden influx of white volunteers who were providing much-needed help reinforced some of these colonial mentalities. Of course, the presence of international volunteers has multiple facets of positives and negatives. Amidst the chaos and the rubble, a new cosmopolitanism in post-disaster Tacloban emerged from the interactions of locals and foreigners. One space where the international workers and locals found common ground beyond a donor-beneficiary dynamic was a temporary mobile bar run by the Tacloban-born entrepreneur Jake Palami.
You can call me Jake. I was born here in Tacloban. Like, I grew up here. I come from a huge family, even for a Filipino family. I'm the youngest of 16. And I was not here when Yolanda happened, but some of my family was. And so I came back soon after, as soon as I could. I was not even in the Philippines back then. I decided to come straight away and do what I can.
Walking around Tacloban in January 2014 and seeing all the aid workers, Jake was inspired to fill a need that he saw.
Tacloban was never a tourist destination, so we wouldn't see a lot of white people at the time. You know, like at night when it was dark, I would see all these foreigners walk around, walk back to their hotels at night for the curfew. And I could tell what they needed, because that's what I needed too, which was a cold drink. And it was like, oh, I wish I had a bar. And so that's how my Yolanda story happened, because I decided to open a truck bar.
One of his brothers had a truck that he was using to transport relief goods from Manila to Tacloban. They decided to refurbish that truck and turn it into a mobile bar. The bar would drive around Tacloban at night and park at random locations. Generators and music and partying and all. The bar was the only one in town at the time, and it became an important gathering space for international aid workers and locals alike.
It was kind of like a huge street party every night, and no one cared. You'd think about the noise we make with the generator and the music and the people. It was loud, but no one cared, because then the locals would join as well. And it was where someone said it in French, but basically he said, okay, this is where the real meetings happen. Because during the day, they'd have all these inter-NGO, inter-agency meetings, and they tried to be so formal about it. But then at night, when everyone's just chill and like honest about things, they would have these conversations in the truck, or in the bar. And that's where the deals happened. I know a lot of people got hired because of it. And it was a great time of my life, meeting all these people and trying to make things happen just by having this, by trying to have this semblance of normalcy.
These deals and hires include international agencies hiring local staff for their typhoon recovery efforts. Jake said business wasn't very good, but his goal was never to make a profit.
We didn't make much money. Yeah, it was never about the business side. I got to know these people intimately, in that one person whose job was to count dead bodies daily. He needed a beer, and he would come to me, and I was the only person he could talk to in that sense. And he was like one of many people who really needed to de-stress to be able to start another day in Tacloban. It was a tough time for them as well.
He said the transient nature of the bar's location reflected his own philosophy at the time.
The symbolism of it being impermanent wasn't lost in me because that's how I was viewing life at the time. You know, I was just like, okay, we don't know where the truck will be tomorrow. The Alaskas, and they were like, I don't know. Like, that's where I was philosophically and mentally. And that was just my way, maybe, of coping. Not by partying per se, but just going along, maybe. So yeah, it ran for maybe 2 years, maybe three.
Jake said the truck bar closed when he saw that there was no longer a need for it, which is around the time when other local bars started opening up. In 2015, Jake also co-organized the Ginsiyaman Music and Art Festival as a farewell and thank you to the aid workers around the time when many of them were wrapping up operations.
It was around when a lot of the volunteers were leaving. It was 2015, maybe 16. It's kind of like a thank you to them. I don't know, I feel like music and the arts and the gift of physical space is so underrated in terms of helping people, I don't know, recover. I really understood the need for a space where people could come together, both locals and non-locals, obviously, because there was such a divide in Tacloban in terms of, okay, I'm from the NGO world, I'm here to help. And then the other side would be like, okay, you help me. There was very little overlap. And I think these intersections were important where they could just be themselves and not be like the helper or the helpee.
We asked Jake when he thought things went back to normal.
We say that a lot, even like a month later, like, okay, it's back to normal. Because again, yeah, normal is relative. So maybe like back to normal really for me was when they left us, the aid workers. I mean, it should be a good sign that they left. And it should be a sign of like, okay, we're gonna be okay. So they had to go. There was no point in them staying.
For his part, Brando Bernadas said some NGOs left too soon. At a meeting with international aid agencies in Metro Manila in 2015, he tried to convince them to stay in Tacloban longer.
There were those who left early. In fact, when I was asked to present an evaluation as to what JICA had given Tacloban in Makati, I was invited to talk. I cried in front of the international communities there present because they wanted to pull out their humanitarian assistance, considering that there are a lot of help already coming in. I said, no, we are not yet done. 2 years was not yet enough. We still need you. I was really crying. When I was already head of the department, CDRIMO, I called for all the humanitarian organizations responsible for emergency response because they were under me for supervision. I pleaded to them. First, I said, thank you for your assistance, but if you can help us draft our plan, contribute anything that you have for us, we will do our part so that we can claim ownership of our plan. We will acknowledge you that you have helped us. There were only four of them that sustained with us. The rest, they pulled out.
What happened 2 years after Yolanda? The magnitude 7.8 earthquake that killed 9,000 people in Nepal. This was the next crisis that international humanitarian organizations needed to dedicate their attention and resources to. Many of our interviewees identified this event as the turning point when aid workers started to leave Tacloban en masse. El Atienza reflects that NGOs need to make sure to empower the local communities to sustain the programs they introduced before they leave a post-disaster area.
Some of the initiatives failed. Not all of the livelihood programs succeeded, maybe because there was no technical knowledge on how to continue activity. So it's important also to give training. If, for instance, you're a donor agency or you're a developmental agency, before turning over a particular facility or a particular structure, it's important that you train people who can manage this. Otherwise, the investment is gone.
She says humanitarianism should focus on empowering local communities to sustain projects and address long-term vulnerabilities.
Instead of contributing to the cyclical problem of patronage and dependency, it's important to change the process. Humanitarianism can also focus on localization and empowerment. And instead of just providing material goods, the important thing is training and empowering and skills building or mentoring people, because eventually they will have to leave and the budget and the priorities will change. They will have to go to other areas, but the important thing is people do not repeat the same tragedies or the same mistakes committed in the past. Otherwise, they go back to the old style, and that will mean we're repeating the same mistakes as before, and who loses in the process? The people.
Next episode, we'll hear about the importance of preserving the stories of Haiyan.
It happened 100 years ago, but we didn't know about it. Why didn't our elders, you know, why didn't this become part of our oral stories?
Carried by Water is a production of Blue Lab at Princeton University. This episode was produced by me, Mario Soriano, along with Patrick Alhoco and Braden Carroll. It was mixed by Braden Carroll. We'd like to express our deepest gratitude to the NGOs we spoke to and those who shared reports for our research: the Tucci Foundation, Yellow Boat of Hope Foundation, Tao Pilipinas Incorporated, Philippine Miserior Partnership Incorporated, Urban Poor Associates, and UNDP Philippines. We also thank Professor Jonathan Ong of the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Harvard University for sharing some research with us. Thanks to our friends
Enzo Kaw
from the Princeton Filipino Community Undergraduate Club and
Napoleon Pempeña
from the newly formed Princeton Filipino Graduate Student Association for providing voiceovers for this episode. For their support and expertise, we also thank the High Meadows Environmental Institute, the Princeton Humanities Council, the Office of the Dean of Research, as well as Cuvenda Media. Allison Carruth is the Director of Blue Lab, and Baron Bixler is the Creative Director. Visit our website, bluelab.princeton.edu, for a complete transcript and photographs for this episode. Until next time,